Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show with your host, Phil Huff. And today, we are joined on the morning show by two guests. We're going to look at the topic of COVID and wildlife in this first segment. The guests are Dr. Nicole Walrath, a DVM, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, I believe that is, a wildlife veterinarian, Wildlife Health and Forensic Laboratory from the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Good morning, Dr. Walrath.
Good morning.
And we also have on the show, Bruce Smith, science writer, wildlife biologist, children's fiction author, and retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And avid listeners may remember about 3-4 years ago, Bruce was on the show talking about mountain goats. And today we're going to explore the broader topic of COVID and wildlife. And welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Thank you, Phil.
So let's hear a little bit more about yourselves, your background, what you do. Bruce, why don't we start with you?
Well, I'm a career wildlife biologist. I spent most of 30 years with the federal government, mainly the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I earned a bachelor's and master's degree in wildlife biology from the University of Montana way back in the dark ages. Halfway through my government career, I earned a doctorate degree from the University of Wyoming in zoology and physiology. My last 22 years with the feds, I was at the National Elk Refuge in Jackson Hole. And that's where I did work on wildlife health, mostly with diseases of elk and bison. Two of my nonfiction books are written about the Jackson Hole elk and include chapters on diseases such as scabies and hemorrhagic septicemia and brucellosis. But I've also written quite a bit and talked quite a bit about chronic wasting disease and my concerns for both population level and ecosystem level effects that there may be with elk that are fed in winter and artificially concentrated. So that federal career ended a few years ago. And since retiring, I've done some contract work for government agencies and non-government organizations, but mostly I've been writing. I've been able to write books about my work with Native Americans, Wildlife on the Wind documents that work, restoring wildlife on the Wind River Indian Reservation. The book that you're familiar with, Phil, Life on the Rocks, the second book ever written about mountain goats. And more recently, I'm writing children's novels that have environmental messages. I just feel it's important to reach children because of the years they have and because they're the ones that are going to pay the right price for our misdeeds. I'm thinking especially of climate change, but also changes in habitat and so forth. And I've worked in some pretty controversial situations as a federal biologist, and I consider my time as a Marine Corps combat veteran one of the things that helped me handle those situations.
That's quite a resume, and we're going to tap into all that expertise in a few moments, but let's turn to Nicole now. Tell us a little bit about your background and how it is you've come to do the work you're doing, and what exactly a wildlife veterinarian does for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game.
Yeah, so my background, I started out in wildlife ecology, and for several years I ended up doing wildlife ecology, animal health kind of side of things. Working with wolf reintroduction, working for the Smithsonian Conservation Research Group, and then working for Henry Dorley Zoo. So that's kind of where I started out. And then I eventually ended up going to vet school in Glasgow, which is in Scotland. And so I got to do quite a bit of work out there doing conservation work as well with my degree. So then I started in a veterinary path with a wildlife focus. So that kind of took me in a couple different directions. I did some elk reintroduction when I first got back to the States. I actually moved down to New Mexico working for a emergency medicine practice. where I also did a lot of their rehabilitation as well. And then I ended up getting a position with Idaho Fish and Game, and I've been here for the last 4 years. I started out with their fish health side of things. So I was their fisheries veterinarian for the first amount of time. And now I'm their wildlife vet and their fisheries vet. So what that typically entails is you do a lot of disease investigations. So you're doing a lot of necropsies, trying to figure out cause of death in a lot of these animals. We're doing a lot of surveillance. So we're doing, anytime we get our hands on animals, whether it's translocating animals that shouldn't be in a place that they're at, or if they die, we get samples from those. And we also do a lot of research projects where we're putting collars on animals. So in all those different scenarios, we're collecting samples to get disease surveillance. With that being said, I'm also training and helping in these research projects, getting collars on animals so we get more population data from them. So how to do these handlings, how to do these captures, helping them with immobilization. So using drugs to chemically kind of sedate these animals so we can handle them. Those kind of projects come up quite frequently. We also do a lot of translocation of animals. So anytime you're moving animals across state lines, typically the wildlife vet and Department of Ag are both involved in trying to make sure we're not transferring diseases across state lines as well. So those, that's kind of a brief overview, but there's a lot of little pockets that we're involved in.
So it's almost a little bit of like crime scene investigation work. You can tell the causes perhaps and thereby help to prevent future problems.
Well, and one of the cool things is our lab's kind of unique because we also have a genetics portion. So that's kind of our forensics lab portion. So not only do I do cause of death through necropsies and radiographs and things like that, but we also can trace back, you know, DNA. Was this meat the same from this antler or from this hide that we found somewhere on location? So our conservation officers use that quite a bit.
Well, thank you. And again, there's so much we could go on with that work, and perhaps on a future show, we can look at some other topics. But today we wanted to cover COVID-19 because this is an emerging topic, at least in literature that I've been reading, and I don't think is widely known by folks who listen regularly to the show. I want to start and set the stage by quoting from the CDC and then getting both of you to help really help me and help our listeners understand what the CDC is saying. The risk of getting COVID-19 from animals in the United States, including wildlife, is low. We know that some mammals can be infected with the virus that causes COVID-19, and there is evidence that some free-ranging wildlife have been infected in the United States. So let's take a look at that. What's the possibility that COVID spread is occurring with wildlife and that it could boomerang back to us? And what are the threats it might produce? So I think to set the stage, maybe we should even just step back for a moment and talk about the general overview of disease spread from humans to animals. And again, our listeners may be familiar with things like the rabies virus or Lyme disease or other tick-borne illnesses. How prevalent is the general challenge of disease spread from animals of all kinds to humans?
Well, maybe I'll start, Nicole, and I'm sure you've got tons to add to this, but I like to think of it broadly and then narrowing down more to the individual disease or species that we're talking about. Infectious diseases that are transmissible between animals and humans are called zoonotic diseases. There are many of them. In fact, about 60% of all human infectious diseases are zoonoses, such as rabies, bubonic plague, Lyme's disease, West Nile fever, hantavirus, anthrax, Ebola, HIV, AIDS, and pretty much every human influenza, including the Spanish flu from 1918. Just the most recent one of significance we're talking about is COVID-19, but there are many, many other zoonotic diseases worldwide. And now an estimated 75% of all new emerging human diseases are of animal origin. So we're not talking about anything new with COVID-19 being a zoonotic disease. However, we're just beginning to learn about the significance of that, what animals it is infected, are infected with that, how they might have become infected, and then what that means for human health.
Thank you, Bruce, for that excellent summary. Nicole, why don't you pick it up from there? Is there anything to add to that? And especially with, we're looking at most of these being wildlife populations, but also with your background with the domestic zoo animals and how they fit into this.
Yeah, so, I mean, like you said earlier, we have so many different pathogens that cause zoonotic disease or transmission, both from animals to humans, but humans to animals as well, or from different animal species as well. It's an ongoing issue that we're constantly managing every year, even in Idaho. The primary ones that we are concerned with in Idaho are hantavirus, avian influenza. Both of those are virus, upper respiratory viruses that humans get from wildlife, which is relatable to COVID transmission. We also have brucellosis, which I'm sure Bruce knows a lot about. He was in that area where we have a lot of brucellosis in elk that we can transmit to humans as well. So there's a lot of different things. We constantly have rabies issues here and there that spring up. But all of these are pathogens that we live with on a continual basis that are a risk to human. Some are more pathogenic than others, which means can be lethal to humans if they get it. Others are more benign. So it's just kind of what is the burden, what does the threat look like, and what is the likelihood of transmission? So we know that for some of these other species and diseases, but for COVID, we're still on the fence of what that actually means in the research side of things. We do have some information, but you know, we're still learning a lot as we get to know this disease down the road.
To me, there's a couple interesting distinctions here, and this is probably a non-scientific term, and maybe there is one, but there's those that are transmissible by bites like mosquitoes or ticks or rabies, and then those that are the respiratory that, as you've mentioned, there are the avian flus, and in this case, of course, COVID. And so I think, you know, we're zeroing in here on the COVID situation being a respiratory response. It seems like the other distinction that's of interest here is that in the case of COVID, at least, it looks like we're looking first at transmission from a human population into the wildlife population, and then it acting as a reservoir for return. Does that have a corollary anywhere?
We have had seen that in avian influenza before, quite a bit. Actually, that's why we do surveillance so heavily with avian influenza, because it constantly is showing mutations or recombinations in how it presents. Some are more pathogenic to humans than others, and some are more pathogenic in different avian species than others. So we'll start to see die-offs in birds that we don't typically see die-offs because it maybe changed its form. So that's one thing that's constantly being monitored, mostly by the federal government, because of their flyway zones. They kind of manage those populations a little more heavily, but it is something that's constantly a concern, and certain animals are more likely to do recombination of certain viruses based on their receptor types. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds with the science aspect, but certain species are more susceptible to certain diseases and their recombinations because their receptor types are so similar. So for us, you know, other primates are very close in receptor types. Deer are kind of close, but actually felids are a little closer. Hamsters are a little closer. So there are all of these different things that we're trying to take into consideration when we're looking at which animals are we more likely to be at risk of recombination and coming back to humans. So with that being said, cats are actually something that's on the radar, and hamsters are more on the radar for risk of recombination of the viral agent and then spreading it back to humans because we have them in our households.
So are there specific precautions we ought to be thinking about or taking with regards to our pets?
It's one of those issues of, you know, like anything, we try to prevent spreading it to ourselves, but we try to prevent spreading it to animals. Whenever we work on animals that are susceptible as part of fish and game, we wear a mask and when we're handling these guys because we don't want to spread it to them. But then the off chances, you know, getting it back from them, handling these animals, it's a respiratory disease. So it's saliva, it's, you know, that respiratory debris or spittle that can cause that transmission. So that's more what we're at risk. So trying to mitigate that as much as possible. That being said, we don't look for it in our domestics very often, at least not our pets. So it's just something that we always like to keep in the back of our minds. There was one positive transmission from a little girl that got it from her hamster in China. And then China tried to depopulate the hamster population. Now, I don't always know what the best route forward, you know, human diseases are always tricky to manage. And so it's just kind of looking at what the risk factors are and what's the likelihood of causing a severe disease back to humans.
And there's a social equation in here. It's a very difficult thing to analyze the cost benefit of not having close contact with your beloved pets and the risk of transmission. I just know I'll never get my cat to wear a face mask. It isn't right. Happening. It's not a political statement. It's just not in their makeup.
Right.
But I think, you know, looking at some of the recent research being done on this, it's really interesting. This first came to light to me from a blog post, Bruce, that you had looking at whitetail deer studies, which in at least four states, Illinois, New York, Michigan, Pennsylvania, have shown that they've picked up COVID and have the potential to respread that. Can you tell us anything more about those studies? Of particular interest, I think, is have there been any findings as to how COVID was actually introduced to them? It's hard to imagine a hunter getting that close to the deer to breathe the same air.
I'll start with a qualifier that I don't do this kind of work. I'm not a disease pathologist. I'm not an epidemiologist. I just pick it up from what I read, hopefully from reliable sources. So what I understand is that in 2020, scientists in Iowa found the virus that causes COVID-19 in 60% of sampled white-tailed deer in the southeast part of the state, which was quite alarming, as you can imagine. These animals had antibodies for the virus. I don't recall if they were actually determining if they were seeing clinical disease in the animals. And since then, diagnostic testing of some 4,000 deer in Iowa have shown that it's widely distributed across that state. And then subsequent testing, of course, that sent a lot of red flags up, subsequent testing in other Midwest and Eastern states and in Canada have documented the presence of COVID-19 in white-tailed deer elsewhere. Anywhere from, you know, a small percentage up to 50% in some places. So a major concern about these zoonotic diseases, as opposed to ones that are unique to humans, like smallpox or polio, we're the only host for those diseases. And that's why we've been so successful in eliminating them in human health, is because we could just focus on one host, and it's much easier to put, as you said, a mask on a human than it is a white-tailed deer, or to make a white-tailed deer socially distanced. That's not easy with people sometimes, but certainly easier. And likewise, we can vaccinate humans. We have tremendous technology that works so well for many of these diseases. But when you try and transfer that to 30 million white-tailed deer in North America, it's just not at all practical and logistically possible. So having learned that, it was interesting that I think it was in Ontario last year, they found that white-tailed deer there by looking at the genomic information, they found that white-tailed deer had actually contracted COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, from humans multiple times. And they believe they have one case of what's called a spillback, where the disease was transmitted back to a human because the genetics of the virus were the same. And when I say the same, once SARS-CoV-2 got into white-tailed deer, it began to mutate. And I think they documented dozens of mutations in these white-tailed deer in Ontario. And so there have been some very, I guess they call them highly divergent strains that they've now discovered. And one of those strains is what they documented being transmitted back to a human. So how often this happens, it just depends upon the level of surveillance. And we have limitations on testing and all those sorts of things to be able to determine that.
Sure. And we want to stay within the lanes of our expertise here and not speculate too much, but with variants, it seems likely that one conclusion is the potential risk of a new emergent variant of COVID coming back from the wildlife population. Any thoughts on that from either of you, Nicole, Bruce?
Go ahead, Nicole.
Yeah, well, I mean, when it comes to variations and the risk factors, you know, the biggest thing that I always kind of rely back on is the issue is always, we're always going to have new variants in every, like, if you just look at the flu and how often we have to change the vaccine because the flu changes so often, because it goes through so many different people and different population groups, or because it goes through animals and comes back to humans, all those different dynamics change it. And so when we go to look at a disease like COVID, we vaccinate herd health population concept is you vaccinate a certain portion of your population, then the likelihood of it transferring through the whole population minimizes. So that's great. Well, if you have a reservoir where like deer can get the disease, even if it's the same exact disease, and it's hanging out in this wildlife population, if a human contracts it back, if they're protected with virus, then they're likely not to spread it through the whole group. But if it's a variant that's not protected by that virus, it may spring off a new kind of pathogen response. So people are going to start getting sick, but they might not get sick as heavily. So that's like the concept that we're trying to work within when it comes to keeping humans protected from this virus when it's got a reservoir in a wildlife population that we're trying to manage as well. We're not seeing a lot of pathogen or disease within deer. We're detecting the pathogen like crazy. But when I actually talk to pathologists who do a lot of our histopath on the deer lungs that we get, if they get any, they don't have clinical signs, but they might have a lesion or two that might give them an inference that it was having some clinical level, even subclinical. But yeah, it's just really hard to get a handle on what these different mutations or variants are going to look like as they present back to humans. Is it going to be worse in our the vaccine is not going to protect against it, or is it going to be very similar and our vaccine will cover it and we won't even notice it? So that's what we're trying to see.
So I think that sets us up nicely to move on to what precautions we can take. And it's natural to think of hunters when we think of deer, but in reality, most of us in Idaho, North Idaho, Northwestern Montana live within the wildlife urban interface and have deer frequently running in and out of our yards, across the streets, in front of our cars, and potential for contact from everyone, from hunters to hikers to residents. What precautions can we take? What precautions are reasonable to try to take?
Well, I mean, I can jump on that one if we like. You know, with anything, handling and feeding wildlife is not recommended for a lot of different reasons. But from the disease aspect, obviously, anytime you create a high density, density load of, or a natural high density load of animals in one area, they're more likely to transmit diseases between each other. But also if they're at feed sites, they're going to increase saliva that's being produced and dropped on that area and transfer between each other, as well as humans who are handling that site or moving feed around that site or handing feed to animals. So that's something that we always discourage. There's a lot of other reasons we discourage it as well, but from the aspect of disease transfer, especially respiratory disease transfer, we would discourage any form of feeding of wildlife. That's kind of our big one. As for hunters, because hunters are part of the equation as well, you know, the CDC just recommends a lot of proper handling of meat. When you are actually working out these animals, there's a lot of different CDC recommendations. The big one is wearing gloves, but some states are actually requesting that their hunters wear face masks or shields, and minimize their contact with the mouth, the trachea, and the lungs as much as possible, just to reduce the likely contact between that virus from the respiratory tract to possibly entering our respiratory tract. But once again, as Fish and Game, we always cite, go to CDC for their newest recommendations, and they do recommend that you can eat the meat from these infected animals. It's not carried by blood. They've been able to prove that. But the big thing is just minimize your risk and protect yourself as much as possible, or that you feel comfortable with. But as always, go to your CDC guidelines, because they're the ones doing constant researches, and things change over time.
Good advice, and broadly applicable, not only to deer, of course. Bruce, any thoughts?
Oh, I would just add straying from COVID-19 a little bit. One of my biggest concerns when I worked in Jackson Hole and throughout Western Wyoming, where 75% of all the wild elk in the world are fed, was those feed ground situations are set up to be hotspots for disease outbreaks. And then from there, as those animals migrate out to their summer ranges, spreading it elsewhere, for example, to Idaho, right, Nicole? And now, you know, we know that brucellosis is in Idaho. It probably spilled over from elk in Wyoming that transmitted it either on the summer range or exchange winter ranges. And so feed ground situations, whether it's private feeding or government subsidized feeding, is just a really bad idea. And my big concern is with chronic wasting disease. That will be a game changer in feed grounds. Brucellosis, you know, it causes pathology in elk. It causes abortions, spontaneous abortions, synovitis, and some other debilitating effects. But chronic wasting disease is 100% fatal, and we have no way to treat it. We really have no way to prevent it. All we can do is reduce its amplification, meaning how getting infected, being potential sources for infection of other animals and eventually dying. So whether it's private feeding or government feeding, this should always be discouraged, and we need to do better public education on the importance of trying to not do this. You know, kind of my bottom line is always that it's best to keep wildlife wild. Mm-hmm. What separates wildlife from domestic and captive animals and our pets is wildlife's independence from us. And that means allowing them, you know, providing them and not damaging their habitat so they have room to roam, but also not influencing their behavior and movements through fencing or feeding.
I think that was a stunning statistic. We think of the Grand Tetons, Yellowstone, Greater Yellowstone as such wild country, but repeat the statistic you started out there at the beginning with the elk and the feeding.
There's 23,000 elk in Western Wyoming on the National Elk Refuge in 22 state operated feed grounds. They're fed every winter. They're on those feed grounds for 5 or 6 months. That's 75% of all the elk that are fed. There's a million elk in North America. 3% are fed. 75% of those are in Western Wyoming.
Yeah, and that's remarkable. And we also see, not on that size scale, but we see those things happening in various places throughout Western states with concentrated feeding of wildlife elk, even well-intended, even by authorities. But I think you went through the potential risks of that very nicely, and appreciate that. We've touched on an awful lot, and you know, there's so many topics we could explore, but we're coming to a close of the time we have allotted for our COVID and wildlife discussion. Any other areas relative to this topic that either of you'd like to touch on? Any thoughts about that? Nicole, why don't we go to you?
Yeah, so as we go forward looking at what is the degree or prevalence of COVID in wildlife populations, once again, I just want to emphasize that we are looking for detection, not necessarily disease. So we're looking, is it present, not is it causing disease in our wildlife? So a lot of people get very concerned that it's killing off our wildlife. Well, a lot of them can live quite successfully and happily with this pathogen, but not have disease. We do some surveillance when we do have die-offs just to ensure that it is not caused by COVID. But I do know that the federal government is planning on doing surveillance across all 50 states where they can. And Idaho is one of the locations they are looking at doing prevalence studies in the future. So it's just something to keep in mind. It's good information to have just to keep an eye on it. Like we do any other pathogen, we keep an eye on what the prevalence looks like in each population, not necessarily because we're going to directly manage it, but it's just to keep an eye on where the meter sits on how prevalent it is in each of our populations.
Bruce, any final thoughts for us?
I just think it's good to remind ourselves that we don't exist in isolation. We're we're part of the biosphere with all the other species that are here. And we shouldn't consider human diseases and human health in general in isolation from other species with which we share much of the DNA. And oftentimes, the more closely we're related to species, thinking of other primates in particular, but certainly other mammals, the more likely we share a large proportion of our DNA and some of the pathways for disease processes. So this One Health concept that a program that the CDC began in cooperation with others years ago is important to remind ourselves of. We're not here alone.
Very well put. Well, if you've tuned in partway, this is the Tuesday Morning Show's show on COVID and wildlife with our two guests, Bruce Smith, science writer, wildlife biologist, children's fiction author, and retiree from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Also joining us today was Dr. Nicole Walworth, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, wildlife veterinarian for the Wildlife Health and Forensic Laboratory, part of the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. And thank you both for coming on the show this morning, Bruce and Nicole.
You're welcome.
Nice to be here, Phil. Nice to meet you, Nicole.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you too.
Even if it's virtually.
Thank you both.